Section 2. Reflections upon the preceding account. In viewing the progress of Christianity, our first attention is due to the number of converts at Jerusalem immediately after its founder's death, because this success was a success at the time and upon the spot when and where the chief part of the history had been transacted. We are, in the next place, called upon to attend to the early establishment of numerous Christian societies in Judea and Galilee, which countries had been the scene of Christ's miracles and ministry, and where the memory of what had passed and the knowledge of what was alleged must have yet been fresh and certain. We are, thirdly, invited to recollect the success of the apostles and of their companions at the several places to which they came, both within and without Judea, because it was the credit given to original witnesses, appealing for the truth of their accounts to what themselves had seen and heard. The effect also of their preaching strongly confirms the truth of what our history positively and circumstantially relates, that they were able to exhibit to their hearers supernatural attestations of their mission. We are, lastly, to consider the subsequent growth and spread of the religion, of which we receive successive intimations and satisfactory, though general and occasional, accounts, until its full and final establishment. In all these several stages, the history is without a parallel, for it must be observed that we have not now been tracing the progress and describing the prevalency of an opinion founded upon philosophical or critical arguments, upon mere of reason, or the construction of ancient writing, of which are the several theories which have, at different times, possession of the public mind in various departments of science and literature, and of one or other of which kind are the tenets also which divide the various sects of Christianity. But that we speak of a system, the very basis and postulatum of which was a supernatural character ascribed to a particular person, of a doctrine, the truth whereof depends entirely upon the truth of a matter of fact then recent. To establish a new religion, even amongst a few people or in one single nation, is a thing in itself exceedingly difficult. To reform some corruptions which may have spread in a religion, or to make new regulations in it, is not perhaps so hard when the main and principal part of that religion is preserved entire and unshaken. And yet this very often cannot be accomplished without an extraordinary concurrence of circumstances, and may be attempted 1,000 times without success. But to introduce a new faith, a new way of thinking and acting, and to persuade many nations to quit the religion in which their ancestors have lived and died, which had been delivered down to them from time immemorial, to make them forsake and despise the deities which they had been accustomed to reverence and worship, this is a work of still greater difficulty. Jortin's Disser on the Christ Rel, page 17, the edit. The resistance of education, worldly policy, and superstition is almost invincible. If men in these days be Christians in consequence of their education, in submission to authority, or in compliance with fashion, let us recollect that the very contrary of this at the beginning was the case. The first race of Christians, as wall as millions who succeeded them, became such in formal opposition to all these motives, to the whole power and strength of this influence. Every argument, therefore, and every instance which sets forth the prejudice of education and the almost irresistible effects of that prejudice, and no persons are more fond of expatiating upon this subject than deistical writers, in fact confirms the evidence of Christianity. But in order to judge of the argument which is drawn from the early propagation of Christianity, I know no fairer way of proceeding than to compare what we have seen on the subject with the success of Christian missions in modern ages. In the East India Mission, supported by the Society for Promoting Christian Knowledge, we hear sometimes of 30, sometimes of 40, being baptized in the course of a year, and these principally children. Of converts properly so called, that is, of adults voluntarily embracing Christianity, the number is extremely small. Notwithstanding the labor of missionaries for upwards of 200 years, and the establishments of different Christian nations who support them, there are not 12,000 Indian Christians, and those almost entirely outcasts. Sketches relating to the history, learning, and manners of the Hindus, page 4. Quoted by Dr. Robertson, Heist is concerning ancient India, page 23. I lament as much as any man the little progress which Christianity has made in these countries, and the inconsiderable effect that has followed the labors of its missionaries. But I see in it a strong proof of the divine origin of the religion. What had the apostles to assist them in propagating Christianity which the missionaries have not? If piety and zeal had been sufficient, I doubt not but that our missionaries possess these qualities in a high degree. For nothing except piety and zeal could engage them in the undertaking. If sanctity of life and manners was the allurement, the conduct of these men is unblameable. If the advantage of education and learning be looked to, there is not one of the modern missionaries who is not, in this respect, superior to all the apostles, and that not only absolutely, but, what is of more importance, relatively, in comparison, that is, with those amongst whom they exercise their office. If the intrinsic excellency of the religion, the perfection of its morality, the purity of its precepts, the eloquence or tenderness or sublimity of various parts of its writings were the recommendations by which it made its way, these remain the same. If the character and circumstances under which the preachers were introduced to the countries in which they taught be accounted of importance, this advantage is all on the side of the modern missionaries. They come from a country and a people to which the Indian world look up with sentiments of deference. The apostles came forth amongst the Gentiles under no other name than that of Jews, which was precisely the character they despised and derided. If it be disgraceful in India to become a Christian, it could not be much less so to be enrolled amongst those quos per flagitia invisos vulgus Christianos appellabat. If the religion which they had to encounter be considered, the difference, I apprehend, will not be great. The theology of both was nearly the same. What is supposed to be performed by the power of Jupiter, Neptune, of Iolus, of Mars, of Venus, according to the mythology of the West, is ascribed in the East to the agency Agrio, the god of fire, Varun, the god of oceans, Vayu, god of wind, Kama, the god of love, Bhagavat Gets, Pitna 9, quoted by Dr. Robertson, Inda Dispi, 30. H. Sacred rites of the Western polytheism were gay, festive, and licentious. The rites of the public religion in the East partake of the same character with a more avowed indecency. In every function performed in the pagodas, as well as in every public procession, it is the office of these women, i.e., of women prepared by the Brahmins for the purpose, to dance before the idol, and to sing hymns in his praise, and it is difficult to say whether they trespass most against decency by the gestures they exhibit or by the verses which they recite. The walls of the pagodas were covered with paintings in a style no less indelicate. Others of the deities of the East are of an austere and gloomy character, to be propitiated by victims, sometimes by human sacrifices, and by voluntary torments of the most excruciating kind. Voyage de Gentil, Volume I, P. 2420, Peace to the Code of Gentoo Laws, P. 57, Quid by Dr. Robertson, P. 320. On both sides of the comparison, the popular religion had a strong establishment. In ancient Greece and Rome, it was strictly incorporated with the state. The magistrate was the priest. The highest officers of government bore the most distinguished part in the celebration of the public rites. In India, a powerful and numerous caste possesses exclusively the administration of the established worship, and are, of consequence, devoted to its service and attached to its interest. In both, the prevailing mythology was destitute of any proper evidence, or rather, in both, the origin of the tradition is run up into ages long anterior to the existence of credible history or of written language. The Indian chronology computes eras by millions of years and the life of man by thousands. The Sufek Jog, or Age of Purity, is said to have lasted 3,200,000 years, and they hold that the life of man was extended in that age to 100,000 years. But there is a difference amongst the Indian writers of 6 millions of years in the computation of this era. Voyage de Gentil, Volume 1, page 2420, Peace to the Code of Gentoo Laws, page 57, quoted by Dr. Robertson, page 320. And here, or prior to these, is placed the history of their divinities. In both, the established superstition held the same place in the public opinion. That is to say, in both it was credited by the bulk of the people, but by the learned and philosophical part of the community either derided or regarded by them as only fit to be upholden for the sake of its political uses. How absurd soever the articles of faith may be which superstition has adopted, or how unhallowed the rites which it prescribes, the former are received in every age and country with unhesitating assent by the great body of the people, and the latter observed with scrupulous exactness. In our reasonings concerning opinions and practices which differ widely from our own, we are extremely apt to err. Having been instructed ourselves in the principles of a religion worthy in every respect of that divine wisdom by which they were dictated, we frequently express wonder at the credulity of nations in embracing systems of belief which appear to us so directly repugnant to right reason, and sometimes suspect that tenets so wild and extravagant do not really gain credit with them. But experience may satisfy us that neither our wonder nor suspicions are well founded. No article of the public religion was called in question by those people of ancient Europe with whose history we are best acquainted, and no practice which it enjoined appeared improper to them. On the other hand, every opinion that tended to diminish the reverence of men for the gods of their country, or to alienate them from their worship, excited, among the Greeks and Romans, that indignant zeal which is natural to every people attached to their religion by a firm persuasion of its truth. Indeed, is page 31. Had the learned Brahmins of the East, are rational theists, and secretly reject the established theory and contemn the rites that were founded upon them, or rather consider them as contrivances to be supported for their political uses, see Dr. Robertson's Industrial Diseases, page 324 to 334. Or if it should be allowed that the ancient heathens believed in their religion less generally than the present Indians do, I am far from thinking that this circumstance would afford any facility to the work of the apostles above that of the modern missionaries. To me it appears, and I think it material to be remarked, that a disbelief of the established religion of their country has no tendency to dispose men for the reception of another, but that, on the contrary, it generates a settled contempt of all religious pretensions whatever. General infidelity is the hardest soil which the propagators of a new religion can have to work upon. Could a Methodist or Moravian promise himself a better chance of success with a French esprit fort who had been accustomed to laugh at the popery of his country than with a believing Mahometan or Hindu? Or are our modern unbelievers in Christianity, for that reason, in danger of becoming Mahometans or Hindus? It does not appear that the Jews, who had a body of historical evidence to offer for their religion, and who at that time undoubtedly entertained and held forth the expectation of a future state, derived any great advantage as to the extension of their system from the discredit into which the popular religion had fallen with many of their heathen neighbors. We have particularly directed our observations to the state and progress of Christianity amongst the inhabitants of India. But the history of the Christian mission in other countries, where the efficacy of the mission is left solely to the conviction wrought by the preaching of strangers, presents the same idea as the Indian mission does, of the feebleness and inadequacy of human means. About 25 years ago was published in England a translation from the Dutch of a history of Greenland and a relation of the mission for above 30 years carried on in that country by the Unitas Fratrum, or Moravians. Every part of that relation confirms the opinion we have stated. Nothing could surpass or hardly equal the zeal and patience of the missionaries. Yet their historian, in the conclusion of his narrative, could find place for no reflections more encouraging than the following. A person that had known the heathen, that had seen the little benefit from the great pains hitherto taken with them, and considered that one after another had abandoned all hopes of the conversion of these infidels, and some thought they would never be converted till they saw miracles wrought as in the apostles' days, and this the Greenlanders expected and demanded of their instructors. One that considered this, I say, would not so much wonder at the past unfruitfulness of these young beginners as at their steadfast perseverance in the midst of nothing but distress, difficulties, and impediments internally and externally, and that they never desponded of the conversion of those poor creatures amidst all seeming impossibilities. History of Greenland, Volume, where to page 36. From the widely disproportionate effects which attend the preaching of modern missionaries of Christianity, compared with what followed the ministry of Christ and his apostles under circumstances either alike or not so unlike as to account for the difference, a conclusion is fairly drawn in support of what our histories deliver concerning them, viz. That they possessed means of conviction which we have not, that they had proofs to appeal to which we want. Section 3. Of the Religion of Muhammad. The only event in the history of the human species which admits of comparison with the propagation of Christianity is the success of Mohammedanism. The Mohammedan institution was rapid in its progress, was recent in its history, and was founded upon a supernatural or prophetic character assumed by its author. In these articles, the resemblance with Christianity is confessed, but there are points of difference which separate, we apprehend, the two cases entirely. I, Muhammad, did not found his pretensions upon miracles, properly so called, that is, upon proofs of supernatural agency capable of being known and attested by others. Christians are warranted in this assertion by the evidence of the Quran, in which Muhammad not only does not affect the power of working miracles, but expressly disclaims it. The following passages of that book furnish direct proofs of the truth of what we allege. The infidels say, "Unless a sign be sent down unto him from his Lord, we will not believe. Thou art a preacher only." Sales Quran, Sidrathert D. for 21, D. Quarto. Again, "Nothing hindered us from sending thee with miracles, except that the former nations have charged them with imposture." See 17th page 232, and lastly. They say, "Unless a sign be sent down unto him from his Lord, we will not believe." Answer, "Signs are in the power of God alone, and I am no more than a public preacher. Is it not sufficient for them that we have sent down unto them the book of the Quran to be read unto them?" See the Minanadanth, p. 328. BSD He's acknowledgments, I have observed 13 distinct places in which Muhammad puts the objection, "unless a sign," and "see," into the mouth of the unbeliever, in not one of which does he allege a miracle in reply. His answer is that God giveth the power of working miracles when and to whom he pleaseth, CVX Nairton twice, that if he should work miracles, they would not believe, see Ver, that they had before rejected Moses and Jesus and the prophets who wrought miracles, see the 3:21-28, that the Quran itself was a miracle, see 16th. The only place in the Quran in which it can be pretended that a sensible miracle is referred to, for I do not allow the secret visitations of Gabriel, the night journey of Mahomet to heaven, or the presence in battle of invisible hosts of angels to deserve the name of sensible miracles, is the beginning of the 54th chapter. The words are these: "The hour of judgment approacheth, and the moon hath been split in sunder. But if the unbelievers see a sign, they turn aside, saying, This is a powerful charm." The Mohammedan expositors disagree in their interpretation of this passage, some explaining it to be mention of the splitting of the moon as one of the future signs of the approach of the Day of Judgment, others referring it to a miraculous appearance which had then taken place, vid sail in loci. It seems to me not improbable that Mahomet might have taken advantage of some extraordinary halo or other unusual appearance of the moon which had happened about this time, and which supplied a foundation both for this passage and for the story which in after times had been raised out of it. After this more than silence, after these authentic confessions of the Quran, we are not to be moved with miraculous stories related of Muhammad by Abul Feda, who wrote his life about 600 years after his death, or which are found in the legend of Al-Janabi, who came 200 years later. On the contrary, from comparing what Muhammad himself wrote and said with what was afterwards reported of him by his followers, the plain and fair conclusion is that when the religion was established by conquest, Then, and not till then, came out the stories of his miracles. It does not, I think, appear that these historians had any written accounts to appeal to more ancient than the Sana, which was a collection of traditions made by order of the caliphs 200 years after Mahomet's death. Mahomet died A.D. 62 El-Bukhari, one of the six doctors who compiled the Sana, was born A.D. 89, i.e. 869, Prideaux's Life of Mahomet, page 12, D.M. 7th. Now, this difference alone constitutes, in my opinion, a bar to all reasoning from one case to the other. The success of a religion founded upon a miraculous history shows the credit which was given to the history. And this credit, under the circumstances in which it was given, i.e., by persons capable of knowing the truth and interested to inquire after it, is evidence of the reality of the history, and, by consequence, of the truth of the religion. Where a miraculous history is not alleged, no part of this argument can be applied. We admit that multitudes acknowledge the pretensions of Muhammad, but these pretensions being destitute of miraculous evidence, we know that the grounds upon which they were acknowledged could not be secure grounds of persuasion to his followers, nor their example any authority to us. Admit the whole of Muhammad's authentic history, so far as it was of a nature capable of being known or witnessed by others, to be true, which is certainly to admit all that the reception of the religion can be brought to prove, and Mahomet might still be an impostor, or enthusiast, or a union of both. Admit to be true almost any part of Christ's history, of that I mean, which was public, and within the cognizance of his followers, and he must have come from God. Where matter of fact is not in question, where miracles are not alleged, I do not see that the progress of a religion is a better argument of its truth than the prevalency of any system of opinions in natural religion, morality, or physics, is a proof of the truth of those opinions. And we know that this sort of argument is inadmissible in any branch of philosophy whatever. But it will be said, if one religion could make its way without miracles, why might not another? To which I reply, first, that this is not the question. The proper question is not whether a religious institution could be set up without miracles, but whether a religion or a change of religion founding itself in miracles could succeed without any reality to rest upon. I apprehend these two cases to be very different, and I apprehend Mahomet's not taking this course to be one proof, amongst others, that the thing is difficult, if not impossible, to be accomplished. Certainly, it was not from an unconsciousness of the value and importance of miraculous evidence, for it is very observable that in the same volume, and sometimes in the same chapters, in which Muhammad so repeatedly disclaims the power of working miracles himself, he is incessantly referring to the miracles of preceding prophets. One would imagine, to hear some men talk or to read some books, that the setting up of a religion by dint of miraculous pretenses was a thing of every day's experience, whereas I believe that, except the Jewish and Christian religion, there is no tolerably well authenticated account of any such thing having been accomplished. Second, the establishment of Muhammad's religion was effected by causes which in no degree appertain to the origin of Christianity. During the first 12 years of his mission, Muhammad had recourse only to persuasion. This is allowed. And there is sufficient reason from the effect to believe that, if he had confined himself to this mode of propagating his religion, we of the present day should never have heard either of him or it. 3 years were silently employed in the conversion of 14 proselytes. For 10 years the religion advanced with a slow and painful progress within the walls of Mecca. The number of proselytes in the 7th year of his mission may be estimated by the absence of 83 men and 18 women who retired to Ethiopia. Gibbon's Historie, Volume 9, page 24, T.C. Keir's edition, Dub. Yet this progress, such as it was, appears to have been aided by some very important advantages which Muhammad found in his situation, in his mode of conducting his design, and in his doctrine. Muhammad was the grandson of the most powerful and honorable family in Mecca, and although the early death of his father had not left him a patrimony suitable to his birth, he had, long before the commencement of his mission, repaired this deficiency by an opulent marriage. A person considerable by his wealth, of high descent, and nearly allied to the chiefs of his country, taking upon himself the character of a religious teacher, would not fail of attracting attention and followers. Muhammad conducted his design, in the outset especially, with great art and prudence. He conducted it as a politician would conduct a plot. His first application was to his own family. This gained him his wife's uncle, a considerable person in Mecca, together with his cousin Ali, afterwards the celebrated caliph, then a youth of great expectation, and even already distinguished by his attachment, impetuosity, and courage. He next expressed himself to Abu Bir, a man amongst the first of the Quraysh in wealth and influence. The interest and example of Abu Bir drew in five other principal persons in Mecca, whose solicitations prevailed upon five more of the same rank. This was the work of 3 years, during which time everything was transacted in secret. Upon the strength of these allies, and under the powerful protection of his family, who, however, some of them might disapprove his enterprise or deride his pretensions, would not suffer the orphan of their house, the relict of their favorite brother, to be insulted, Muhammad now commenced his public preaching. And the advance which he made during the 9 or 10 remaining years of his peaceable ministry was by no means greater than what, with these advantages, and with the additional and singular circumstance of there being no established religion at Mecca at that time to contend with, might reasonably have been expected. How soon his primitive adherents were led into the secret of his views of empire, or in what stage of his undertaking these views first opened themselves to his own mind, it is not now easy to determine. The event, however, was that these, his first proselytes, all ultimately attained to riches and honors, to the command of armies, and the government of kingdoms. Gibbon, Volume 9, page 24. Of which Mr. Gibbon has preserved the following specimen. When Mahomet called out in an assembly of his family, "Who among you will be my companion and my vizier?" Ali, then only in the 14th year of his age, suddenly replied, "O Prophet, I am the man. Whosoever rises against thee, I will dash out his teeth, tear out his eyes, break his legs, rip up his belly. O Prophet, I will be thy vizier over them." Volume 9, page 25. The Arabs deduced their descent from Abraham through the line of Ishmael. The inhabitants of Mecca, in common probably with the other Arabian tribes, acknowledged, as I think may clearly be collected from the Quran, one supreme deity, but had associated with him many objects of idolatrous worship. The great doctrine with which Muhammad set out was the strict and exclusive unity of God. Abraham, he told them, their illustrious ancestor, Ishmael, the father of their nation, Moses, the lawgiver of the Jews, and Jesus, the author of Christianity, had all asserted the same thing, that their followers had universally corrupted the truth, and that he was now commissioned to restore it to the world. Was it to be wondered at that a doctrine so specious and authorized by names, some or other of which were holden in the highest veneration by every description of his hearers, should, in the hands of a popular missionary, prevailed to the extent in which Muhammad succeeded by his pacific ministry? Of the institution which Muhammad joined with this fundamental doctrine, and of the Quran in which that institution is delivered, we discover, I think, two purposes that pervade the whole, viz. To make converts, and to make his converts soldiers. The following particulars, amongst others, may be considered as pretty evident indications of these designs. When Muhammad began to preach, his address to the Jews, to the Christians, and to the pagan Arabs was that the religion which he taught was no other than what had been originally their own. "We believe in God, and that which hath been sent down unto us, and that which hath been sent down unto Abraham, and Ishmael, and Isaac, and Jacob, and the tribes, and that which was delivered unto Moses and Jesus, and that which was delivered unto the prophets from their Lord. We make no distinction between any of them," Sales Quran, circa 2, page 7. "He hath ordained you the religion which he commanded Noah, and which we have revealed unto thee, O Muhammad, and which we commanded Abraham and Moses and Jesus, saying, Observe this religion, and be not divided therein." Sales Quran, chapter 42, page 393. "Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. He hath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. Ahath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in the religion which he hath given you, the religion of your father Abraham. Saleh's Quran, chapter 42, page 393. He hath chosen you, and hath not imposed on you any difficulty in capítulo 22, página 281. The author of the Quran never ceases from describing the future anguish of unbelievers, their despair, regret, penitence, and torment. It is the point which he labors above all others, and these descriptions are conceived in terms which will appear in no small degree impressive, even to the modern reader of an English translation. Doubtless they would operate with much greater force upon the minds of those to whom they were immediately directed. The terror which they seem well calculated to inspire would be to many tempers a powerful application. On the other hand, his voluptuous paradise, his robes of silk, his palaces of marble, his riven and shades, his groves and couches, his wines, his dainties, and above all, his 72 virgins assigned to each of the faithful, of resplendent beauty and eternal youth, intoxicated the imaginations and seized the passions of his Eastern followers. But Muhammad's highest heaven was reserved for those who fought his battles or expended their fortunes in his cause. Those believers who sit still at home, not having any hurt, and those who employ their fortunes and their persons for the religion of God shall not be held equal. God hath preferred those who employ their fortunes and their persons in that cause to a degree above those who sit at home. God had indeed promised everyone paradise, but God had preferred those who fight for the faith before those who sit still, by adding unto them a great reward, by degrees of honor conferred upon them from Him, and by granting them forgiveness and mercy. Sal's Quran, C4, P7. Again, do you reckon the giving drink to the pilgrims and the visiting of the Holy Temple to be actions as meritorious as those performed by him who believeth in God and the Last Day and fighteth for the religion of God? They shall not be held equal with God, they who have believed and fled their country and employed their substance and their persons in the defense of God's true religion shall be in the highest degree of honor with God. And these are they who shall be happy. The Lord sendeth them good tidings of mercy from Him, and good will, and of gardens wherein they shall enjoy lasting pleasures. They shall continue therein forever, for with God is a great reward. Saleh's Quran, chapter 9, page 11. And once more, verily God hath purchased of the true believers their souls and their substance, promising them the enjoyment of paradise, on condition that they fight for the cause of God, whether they slay or be slain. The promise for the same is assuredly due by the law and the gospel and the Quran. Sales Quran, chapter 9, page 164. The sword, saith Mahomet, is the key of heaven and of hell. A drop of blood shed in the cause of God, a night spent in arms, is of more avail than 2 months fasting or prayer. Whosoever falls in battle, his sins are forgiven at the day of judgment. His wounds shall be resplendent as vermilion and odoriferous as musk, and the loss of his limbs shall be supplied by the wings of angels and cherubim. Gibbon, Volume 9, page 26. His doctrine of predestination was applicable, and was applied by him to the same purpose of fortifying and of exalting the courage of his adherents. If anything of the matter had happened unto us, we had not been slain here. Answer, if ye had been in your houses, verily they would have gone forth to fight, whose slaughter was decreed, to the places where they died. Sales Quran, see that he tuttered, P4. In warm regions, the appetite of the sexes is ardent, the passion for inebriating liquors moderate. In compliance with this distinction, although Muhammad laid a restraint upon the drinking of wine, in the use of women, he allowed an almost unbounded indulgence. Four wives, with the liberty of changing them at pleasure, Sales Quran, chapter 4, page 3, together with the persons of all his captives, Gibbon, volume. Iknard P. 225, is an irresistible bribe to an Arabian warrior. God is minded, says he, speaking of this very subject, to make his religion light unto you, for man was created weak. How different this from the unaccommodating purity of the gospel! How would Muhammad have succeeded with the Christian lesson in his mouth? Whosoever looketh upon a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. It must be added that Muhammad did not venture upon the prohibition of wine till the fourth year of the Hijra, or the 17th of his mission, when his military successes had completely established his authority. The same observation holds of the fast of the Ramadan, Modern University History, Volume 1, pages 16 and 112, and of the most laborious part of his institution, the pilgrimage to Mecca. This latter, however, already prevailed amongst the Arabs and had grown out of their excessive veneration for the Kaaba. Mahomet's law, in this respect, was rather a compliance than an innovation. Sale's Preliminary Discussion, page 12. What has hitherto been collected from the records of the Muslim history relates to the 12 or 13 years of Mahomet's peaceable preaching, which part alone of his life and enterprise admits of the smallest comparison with the origin of Christianity. A new scene is now unfolded. The city of Medina, distant about 10 days' journey from Mecca, was at that time distracted by the hereditary contentions of two hostile tribes. These feuds were exasperated by the mutual persecutions of the Jews and Christians, and of the different Christian sects by which the city was inhabited. Marv Univeris Histos Volubridi P. 10. The religion of Mahomet presented, in some measure, a point of union or compromise to these divided opinions. It embraced the principles which were common to them all. Each party saw in it an honorable acknowledgement of the fundamental truth of their own system. To the pagan Arab, somewhat imbued with the sentiments and knowledge of his Jewish or Christian fellow citizen, it offered no defensive or very improbable theology. This recommendation procured to Mohammedanism a more favorable reception at Medina than its author had been able, by 12 years' painful endeavors, to obtain for it at Mecca. Yet, after all, the progress of the religion was inconsiderable. His missionary could only collect a congregation of 40 persons. It was not a religious but a political association which ultimately introduced Mohammed into Medina. Harassed as it should seem, and disgusted by the long continuance of factions and disputes, the inhabitants of that city saw in the admission of the Prophet's authority a rest from the miseries which they had suffered, and a suppression of the violence and fury which they had learned to condemn. After an embassy, therefore, composed of believers and unbelievers, Modern University History, Volume 1, page 8, and of persons of both tribes with whom a treaty was concluded of strict alliance and support, Mahomet made his public entry and was received as the sovereign of Medina. From this time, or soon after this time, the impostor changed his language and his conduct. Having now a town at his command, where to arm his party and to head them with security, he enters upon new counsels. He now pretends that a divine commission is given him to attack the infidels, to destroy idolatry, and to set up the true faith by the sword, Mod Univers Heisten Full IP 8. An early victory over a very superior force, achieved by conduct and bravery, established the renown of his arms and of his personal character. Victory of Bedr, Modern University History, Volume 1, page 16. Every year after this was marked by battles or assassinations. The nature and activity of Muhammad's future exertions may be estimated from the computation that in the 9 following years of his life, he commanded his army in person in 8 general engagements, Modern University History, Volume 1, page 25, and undertook by himself or his lieutenants 50 military enterprises. From this time we have nothing left to account for but that Muhammad should collect an army, that his army should conquer, and that his religion should proceed together with his conquests. The ordinary experience of human affairs leaves us little to wonder at in any of these effects. And they were likewise each assisted by peculiar facilities. From all sides, the roving Arabs crowded round the standard of religion and plunder, of freedom and victory, of arms and rapine. Beside the highly painted joys of a carnal paradise, Mahomet rewarded his followers in this world with a liberal division of the spoils and with the persons of their female captives. Gibbon, Volume 9, page 25. The condition of Arabia, occupied by small independent tribes, exposed it to the impression and yielded to the progress of a firm and resolute army. After the reduction of his native peninsula, The weakness also of the Roman provinces on the north and the west, as well as the distracted state of the Persian Empire on the east, facilitated the successful invasion of neighboring countries. That Mahomet's conquests should carry his religion along with them will excite little surprise when we know the conditions which he proposed to the vanquished. Death or conversion was the only choice offered to idolaters. Strike off their heads, strike off all the ends of their fingers, sales Quran, circa, Bidavani PD 10, kill the idolaters wheresoever ye shall find them. Sales Quran, C, Denud P, 149. He Jews and Christians was left the somewhat milder alternative of subjection and tribute, if they persisted in their own religion, or of an equal participation in the rights and liberties, the honors and privileges of the faithful, if they embraced the religion of their conquerors. Ye Christian dogs, you know your option, the Quran, the tribute, or the sword. Gibbon, Volume 9, page 37. The corrupted state of Christianity in the 7th century, and the contentions of its sects, unhappily so, fell in with men's care of their safety or their fortunes, as to induce many to forsake its profession. Add to all which, that Muhammad's victories not only operated by the natural effect of conquest, but that they were constantly represented, both to his friends and enemies, as divine declarations in his favor. Success was evidence. Prosperity carried with it not only influence, but proof. Ye have already, says he, after the Battle of Badr, had a miracle shown you in two armies which attacked each other. One army fought for God's true religion, but the other were infidels. Sal's Quran, Sayyidan Shi, Qarfi 3. Again, ye slew not those who were slain at Badr, but God slew them. If ye desire a decision of the matter between us, now hath a decision come unto you. Sal's Quran, chapter 8, page 11. Many more passages might be collected out of the Quran to the same effect, but they are unnecessary. The success of Mohammedanism during this, and indeed every future period of its history, bears so little resemblance to the early propagation of Christianity that no inference whatever can justly be drawn from it to the prejudice of the Christian argument. For what are we comparing? A Galilean peasant accompanied by a few fishermen with a conqueror at the head of his army. We compare Jesus without force, without power, without support, without one external circumstance of attraction or influence, prevailing against the prejudices, the learning, the hierarchy of his country, against the ancient religious opinions, the pompous religious rites, the philosophy, the wisdom, the authority of the Roman Empire in the most polished and enlightened period of its existence, with Muhammad making his way amongst Arabs, collecting followers in the midst of conquests and triumphs in the darkest ages and countries of the world, and when success in arms, not only operated by that command of men's wills and persons which attend prosperous undertakings, but was considered as a sure testimony of divine approbation. That multitudes, persuaded by this argument, should join the train of a victorious chief, that still greater multitudes should, without any argument, bow down before irresistible power, is a conduct in which we cannot see much to surprise us, in which we can see nothing that resembles the causes by which the establishment of Christianity was effected. The success, therefore, of Mohammedanism stands not in the way of this important conclusion, that the propagation of Christianity, in the manner and under the circumstances in which it was propagated, is an unique in the history of the species. A Jewish peasant overthrew the religion of the world. I have, nevertheless, placed the prevalency of the religion amongst the auxiliary arguments of its truth, because, whether it had prevailed or not, or whether its prevalency can or cannot be accounted for, the direct argument remains still. It is still true that a great number of men upon the spot, personally connected with the history and with the author of the religion, were induced by what they heard and saw and knew not only to change their former opinions, but to give up their time and sacrifice their ease, to traverse seas and kingdoms without rest and without weariness, to commit themselves to extreme dangers, to undertake incessant toils, to undergo grievous sufferings, and all this solely in consequence and in support of their belief of facts which, if true, establish the truth of the religion, which, if false, they must have known to be so.